Oh, it's lovely to have you here and to think together about submission in the American presidency, tracing the prehistory of Michelle Bachmann and Sarah Palin. As I have watched American politics unfold over the last few years, I've been struck by the number of women of significance in both parties that have garnered considerable attention and support in the United States. And it strikes me that this is an indication of a bit of a sea change for American politics. And no matter what the political stripe might be, the fact that we see women in these significant positions gaining a considerable amount of public attention is itself an indicator of a movement that is not a small matter for political culture here in North America. I'm delighted this evening that Emily Johnson is with us. Emily graduated from the University of Alberta in 2007, studying history and women's studies, and then went off to graduate school at Yale to work on religion and cultural history in America. And her dissertation will focus on women's leadership in the new religious right during the emergence, as it emerged through the 1970s, and as it will likely be with us for some time. So this evening, she's going to speak about submission and the American presidency, the prehistory. It's always good to speak about prehistory in Alberta, of Michelle Bachmann and Sarah Palin. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you all for coming. I'm going to speak in sort of three sections today. I'm going to start out by talking about some of the more contemporary events that this talk is hoping to trace the history of. Then I'm going to give you a little bit of a history of what I'm calling the new Christian right or the modern religious right, and then we'll really dig into my dissertation research, which is women's leadership in this movement in the 1970s. And after each of these sections, I'd like to open it up for questions, and then at the end I hope that we can have a bigger conversation. But please feel free to stop me at any time for clarification. I've been living in the States for 4 years now, and I'm not entirely sure what's being covered on Canadian media, so just let me know if you need any clarification. Any questions? So last Tuesday in the States, we had Super Tuesday, which I always think is a little bit less exciting than it sounds like it's going to be. It's 10 primary races all at once, and up until this year, it's always been sort of the deciding moment where we see for sure who the candidate for president is going to be. And this year, in the long tradition so far of Mitt Romney, we saw him win, but not as much as he might have liked to, and we still don't know who the candidate is, and hopefully we will know sometime before November. But I'm going to take you back about 7 months to the first of these big primary events, which is the Ames Straw Poll in Iowa. And some of you might remember that it wasn't Mitt Romney, actually, who was the big news coming out of this campaign, but it was actually, or out of this primary, but it was actually Michelle Bachmann. And partly that was because she won, which is, of course, an important element. But a lot of it was because of a question that she was asked at the press conference immediately following the straw poll about how her stated commitment to the doctrine of wifely submission would affect the way that she governed as president if she was to be elected. And this is a very important question. It goes to the heart of everything that I'm interested in researching, everything that I'm talking about today. What does it mean for a woman in a Christian conservative movement that bases much of its politics around an idea of traditional gender roles? What does it mean for a woman to be a leader in that movement? And specifically, in the case of Michelle Bachmann, if we vote for Michelle Bachmann, the subtext was, are we actually voting for Marcus Bachmann, her husband, who really didn't seem to inspire a lot of confidence on either side of the political spectrum? And so this question was immediately controversial. The audience who was at the press conference booed, and Michelle Bachmann got huge laughs just for sort of perfunctorily thanking the reporter for the question. The internet also exploded immediately. Conservatives were incensed that the question had been asked. They saw it as a gotcha question, an unfair question that was intended to embarrass Michelle Bachmann and make her religion seem strange. There was also a subtext there that the question was an obvious one, that the only reason that it would be asked is in order to make Michelle Bachmann seem more foreign, because anyone who is a part of this movement, of this conservative evangelical movement, should understand the complexities of submission. And so this is the reason why it didn't really matter when we found out that the reporter who had asked the question was actually a conservative evangelical himself, because it seemed like an especially strange question for him to ask in that case. The liberal response was a little bit different. Liberals were less concerned with the question and much more concerned with Michelle Bachmann's answer, which was essentially that to her and to Marcus, submission meant respect. And this, the sort of incredulity at this response is summed up really nicely by Leslie Bennett, who wrote for the online magazine The Daily Beast, "No congresswoman. In fact, it doesn't. Words have specific meanings, and your definition is incorrect, just as your answer to the question was disingenuous." And so this was sort of the general response. My favorite retort along this line was from a commenter on another blog who suggested that the congresswoman, quote, replace her Bible with a dictionary. And so I think that this is such a great response because it sums up kind of the ways in which in American politics, there are almost different languages being spoken. Obviously, everyone's speaking English, and that in itself is a big issue. But people are saying words like submission and liberation and women's rights and talking right past each other because these things mean different things to people depending on their political, religious, and cultural backgrounds. And that's the kind that's what I want to illuminate today, is the particular milieu that has borne this conservative religious movement that we see having so much influence in the American political race now. What I specifically want to get at is the ways in which women's leadership is in this movement has been confusing, has been confounding, and has generally been seen as being disingenuous, or women have sort of been thought to be suffering under a false consciousness if they can support this movement's politics. And I want to argue instead that it's much more complicated than that, that these women are being sincere, and that there's a long history of this kind of complication of gender politics in this movement. So that completes our first section. Does anyone have any questions so far that you'd like to raise? Or I was telling my dad that the students at Yale never ask questions, like no matter what. So please do ask questions, but I can wait. All right.
Was there anybody who picked up on the way in which Michelle Bachmann pushed back on that question and actually tried to explore what she meant when she talked about respect and how that was playing in her mind and in the mind of that part of the religious right?
Yeah, so there's a scholar, Armory Griffith, whose work mine is following from, and she wrote a really great piece for Slate about the kind of history that I'm going to be talking about, and you looked down into the comments on that article, which was just really well-written, accessible article that I thought was going to do a great job of explaining this to people, and the comments were just, what is Michelle Bachmann talking about? She's crazy. She obviously doesn't know what she's doing, and there was just sort of no illumination and maybe no desire for understanding.
But I mean, I could imagine within at least part of that, well, you know about this stuff and I don't, so. But I would imagine that in part of that religious world, in a small part of that religious world, not all of it, but a small part of it, the notion of submission is used to do almost anything but respect women. And she's speaking to that world. So do you have any sense that she was trying to enlarge that
notion within that world?
I think that that notion has actually been larger within that world generally for some time, and I will talk about that a bit more later, but I think that she's actually drawing on a much larger tradition of complicated language.
She dropped out in 2012 of the presidential race. Is it just because she was low in the polls, or was there second thoughts on her part, or do you know the details?
No, I don't believe so. It did seem to be just that she was low in the polls. I mean, we know Mitt Romney has insane amounts of money, and I think she knew that she couldn't continue to carry on the campaign against him, that it wasn't worth continuing to spend that money when she wasn't showing well. Yeah.
Did anybody spend any time diving into why the conservative movement was so incensed by the question in the first place? It strikes me, frankly, as odd that anybody would consider any question unfair in the context of American politics.
Well, so that's been a really fun part of this presidential campaign, is this idea of a gotcha question, which both sides have been throwing against each other, that almost every question has been called by someone an unfair gotcha question, and this one just sort of sparked more of a debate, I think, because the debate it sparked on both sides. And so that was, especially in that moment, a really common way of discrediting a reporter or discrediting a question. I was asked about the differences in Canadian and American politics, having grown up here and now living there, and I think a lot of the difference that I've noticed is in a tone of voice where people are yelling at each other a lot more than they're talking, and I think that the gotcha question phenomenon is really a part of that as well. Yeah?
I was wondering, do you think it was a gotcha question? You said it was odd that a conservative Christian would ask that question. Because they would know that it's not that simple an answer. But maybe they were asking, because there are a wide variety of different opinions on submission and conservative Christian movements in the U.S.
Yeah, I think that's why he was asking. I think he's also not as conservative as most of the people who are criticizing him. I think he really felt like that was something that should be eliminated. And probably he thought it would be better eliminated by someone who was part of that culture who asked. I don't think he intended it as a gotcha question. I think he really had sincere motives. So in order to talk about women's leadership in this movement, we really need to talk about what the movement is. And of course I'm going to say that to you because I'm a historian, and I think that we have to always look back into the past. But I've been referring to the new Christian right, or the modern religious right. And this is to refer to the movement that really rose up in the 1970s and 1980s. It was a really diverse movement. It didn't really have particular leaders, although the people we think of most often are sort of Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson as being the leading lights of this movement. And it had a huge influence, and it continues to have a huge influence. Initially, people thought that it was just a passing fad. It was going to go away. It's seen as sort of really coming to its ascendancy in 1978, and there's a scholarly book published in 1982 called The Rise and Fall of the Christian Conservative Movement, which didn't work out. And so we're distinguishing it from a longer history of conservatism and religious political involvement in the United States, and both of these things are really shifting in the 1970s and 1980s, drawing in particular on some trends that begin earlier in the century, in the 1920s. The idea of fundamentalism, the word fundamentalism, is coined in this era in response to a series of books called The Fundamentals that are written in response to a sense that evangelicalism has become too involved in left-wing politics in the early part of the century, too involved in progressive politics and what's being called the social gospel. And the authors of The Fundamentals say that people have to get back to the fundamentals of Christianity, which are Bible reading, church attendance, and winning souls. And so we've had this sense that fundamentalism is necessarily opposed to politics, that it's strange that in the 1970s people suddenly get involved in politics. But if we look back, we see that even these early fundamentalists are really involved in political campaigning, particularly around the issue of evolution in schools. And so we have this sense then that after the 1925 Scopes trial, in which is the first sort of big trial over teaching evolution in schools, and fundamentalists win in the courts. They actually continue to win up to the state Supreme Court. But they kind of lose in the culture, and they end up being really humiliated in this moment. And so historians have argued that at this moment, fundamentalists really retreat from the political scene only to magically arise in the 1970s and be really, really powerful all of a sudden. And of course, that doesn't make a lot of sense, and it's not the case. In fact, there are two really important trends that happen in the decades following the Second World War that lead to the ascendancy of a movement that seems to come out of nowhere in the 70s. And the first of these is a religious trend. Coming out of the Scopes trial, what we actually see is that fundamentalists did move away a little bit from the public eye, but that they retreated into building up a huge infrastructure of conservative, evangelical, and fundamentalist institutions like primary and secondary schools, colleges, publishing houses. We see the birth of Christian contemporary movement in the contemporary Christian music in the 1960s. And so we see this creation of just a huge national evangelical culture in the way that there hasn't been before, of people who are brought together not only by religious belief, but also by cultural experience and largely by political commitments, because these institutions are being founded ultimately by people who are essentially conservative. And yeah. Yeah, so that has been argued, and like that's sort of the general consensus. I think that that's what's happening. There's been some arguments about, like, well, they're still involved in the culture, they're still, but yeah, I would say it's a parallel culture, basically. And we do see sort of really clear parallels. We see Christian country music and Christian punk music and all of these things being created. Oh, and there are also in this period just more evangelicals in general. After the Second World War, we see sort of an exodus from the mainline Protestant churches and a growth of more conservative evangelical churches. And so we have growing numbers and a growing cultural infrastructure that creates this base for what becomes a growing conservative movement also in this period. We tend to think of the 1960s as a really liberal moment in American politics. But actually what we see is, in response to these liberal movements that we think about, a move to the right in the Republican Party as well, and a greater focus on social and cultural issues. Whereas we see conservatism in the 1930s and 40s being largely concerned with economic and political issues, especially opposing the New Deal and its aftermath, we see more of a focus on things like the loosening of obscenity laws in the 1960s, the introduction of sexual education into schools, and there's a general sense of moral declension, that the nation is in decline and that a once godly nation, and the new Israel, is no longer a godly nation, that it's moving away from its Christian roots in a way that is going to be problematic in this world and in the next. And so there's a real sense of urgency to bring America back to God. There's a real romanticization of the past, both the Puritans and the 1950s, as sort of an era of family. And family is absolutely central to this discourse. As I said, sexual education and obscenity laws become a really big thing. The idea of parents' rights, the parents' rights to raise their children in a moral way. And later, this moves into the more familiar issues that we think about now, abortion and contraception and sexuality and the like. And what we see in this movement that's growing up around both a new religious culture and a new conservative culture is a huge involvement of women at the grassroots. There's one historian who's really looked at this and said that specifically, religious women become really effective organizers for this new conservative movement because they have time. A lot of them are housewives in a sort of traditional marriage in that sense, so they have time during the day to do political organizing. But also, the skills you need for evangelism are really similar to the skills that you need for successful political campaigning. You need to be able to approach strangers and friends and want to bring them along to your way of thinking. You need to be really passionate about an issue and believe that people all need to be as passionate about the issue as you do. And so it becomes a really effective way of organizing and of bringing together religion and politics in a way that hadn't been before. The end of the second section. I didn't actually think about like really great transitions for that. It just says part two. So are there questions about that before we move forward? Yeah.
Last year we discussed the book by E.J. Dionne, Sold Out. Are you familiar with that?
I'm not.
You talked about the hijacking.
I am.
Okay.
I already get a lot of flack. I'm in a history department. I'm supposed to be a historian, and I'm studying the 1970s, so I have to be careful about how contemporary I get.
Could you say in that time there was a movement from being more focused on home and hearts and things that affect me and mine, and then moved into the more public, things that are going to affect my country or place in the world, flows into some American foreign policy too. Was there a trend like that, or did it always, were they both always there?
I think that they were both always there, but I think that they shift in a really interesting way in this period. I think that there is sort of a transition to thinking more about larger political issues, about larger political consequences. But at the same time, and particularly with women activists who are involved in this movement, there's also a move towards focusing still on the personal, but making the personal political, which is interesting because it's the same thing that the contemporary feminist movement is doing, but in a completely opposite way. Women like Anita Bryant, who I'm going to talk about later, are speaking as mothers. And the only reason I'm getting involved in this is because I'm a mother, and I'm a concerned mother, and I'm not stepping out of my bounds. This isn't politics. But I'm concerned. She has a great quote. She says, "I'm concerned about my children and all the children of Dade County and all the children of the nation, but ultimately I'm still just a mother."
To what extent was this movement a backlash against intellectual mainstream Protestant liberalism? And I'm thinking of Paul Tillich or the Hebrews and that sort of thing. Or was it not interested in that? Was it more kind of cultural?
It was largely a cultural reaction. There are conservative theologians in this moment who are speaking out against Niebuhr and against Tillich, but the grassroots people that I'm looking at are not really interested in theology in that way. They're building up popular theologies, but they aren't conversant with those kinds of intellectuals.
Thanks.
Yeah.
So I guess it's kind of a loaded question.
I refuse to answer it.
I'm just wondering, has there been any exploration of the dimension to which a kind of profoundly racist society that America has, and the time period, and the fleeing to suburban evangelical churches, all that coming together? There's an attack on public education. There's a rise in private education where you can make your own real rules and you can keep certain people out of your schools. I mean, is there a dimension of this in the rise of evangelicalism and the power of evangelicalism in the 60s and 70s?
Yes, there has been a literature specifically, as you say, on the move to the suburbs, on the racially coded language that we see popping up in this period, because in this period, in response to the civil rights movement, it becomes less and less acceptable to say really obviously racist things in public. And so we see a discussion of crime and law and order and parents' rights to keep their children in the schools they want them to be in. And I actually went to a talk a couple of weeks ago by a man named Gil Frank, who's coming out with a book really soon that draws all of these things together to look specifically at the religious right. I think that his argument is more convincing in some places than others. He is able to draw really clear connections between the anti-equal rights amendment movement and race. Like, they're saying very explicitly racist things. For example, do you believe that homosexuals are a minority? Do you think that they should be equal the way that blacks are now? Do you like how that worked out? And like this series of questions. It's super subtle, yeah. That's what makes it really difficult to study. And so I think in that sense it's convincing. I think that it's not entirely convincing that that was on the minds of everyone, but I think that it did, it contributed to a more general sense of declension, of threat, of being under siege in one's own culture. So whether or not there's an explicit link in the mind of every activist race, I think that that's absolutely part of the anxiety that's coming up in this period.
Yes, another dimension of the mainline Perry Protestant, but I think mainline Protestant plus Roman Catholic denominations, and they tend to become much more involved in social activism. And so some of the fleeing from or putting aside those churches and going to another church that has a different dynamic might also be involved there.
Yes.
Because that kind of political action usually had to do with solidarity with the poor, and the poor typically are visible minorities.
Absolutely, and I think that's one of the really interesting shifts we see in this period, beginning, like I said, in the 1920s, but really in this period, conservatism and religion become fused in the public mind in a way that just isn't logical. Like, if you had said that to someone 2 decades earlier, they would have been confused by the connection. And now we absolutely think, you know, conservatives are religious, liberals are secular, and that's something that's coming out of the discourse of this movement.
So how important, Emily, do you think Richard Nixon's Southern strategy was in giving these kinds of people a political home?
I think it was absolutely important. Nixon almost pioneers the use of law and order as a coded language to talk about race without talking about race. He's really brilliant at talking about these fears without talking about them. And the Southern strategy is a huge part of that. I think that without Nixon, we would have seen a really different discourse come up.
Can you say another sentence for us as Canadians?
About the Southern strategy? Do you want to?
The South, historically in the United States, was democratic. And with the rise of the Civil Rights Movement, there became a real moment of crisis in the Democratic Party. Over issues of race, and what Richard Nixon and his advisors realized was that they could build a new political majority by focusing on turning the South Republican, and there was, as Emily said, a not so disguised racial rhetoric, and I think, as Emily agrees, it gave these conservative religious voices a new home. Within the Republican Party, because the Republican Party, in other words, was no longer the party of plutocrats. The Republican Party took on real meaning with regard to important social issues.
Lincoln was a Republican, and so the Democratic identification against the Republican Party. So we see religion, conservatism, and Republicans all coming together in this moment. All right. So now we move into the meat of my dissertation on conservative women in the 1970s. And what's different about this work than about the work that I've just sort of outlined for you is that I'm arguing that women were absolutely really important at the grassroots of this movement, but that they were important as leaders on the national stage of this movement. I think one of the reasons that we haven't seen them when we've looked back into the history is that they weren't calling themselves leaders in the same way that Bachman and Palin are today. And I'm going to talk about that as one of the important changes that's happened in the era since. But at the same time, these were women who were extremely prominent. They were writing books. Anita Bryant wrote a new book every year in the 1970s. She has 10 books in the space of 10 years. Tammy Faye Baker died at the age of 67 with 4 autobiographies under her belt, so get started. And Beverly LaHaye wrote so many books that I have been researching her for 2 years and still am not totally sure I have a comprehensive list, but it's at least 36 books between 1960 and the 1990s is when she stops being quite so prolific. And these women are largely writing sort of autobiographical advice manuals about Christian womanhood to other women about how to be Christian women. And on the face of them, these are books about submission, about traditional womanhood, about mothering, about domesticity. But if we look deeper into these texts, we see a real complication of submission, which prefaces what we saw in the Iowa straw poll last year. As I said, the ways in which these women claimed leadership or didn't claim it were really complicated, and I'm not by any means arguing that this was an unequivocally feminist, it's absolutely not a feminist movement, it's not unequivocally a movement supporting women's empowerment or women's agency, but it is a movement in which women's leadership is important, and it's important from the get-go. So I'm going to be speaking specifically about 3 women. I've mentioned them already, but I'll give them a little bit more of an introduction. Anita Bryant was a prominent evangelical singer and author. She became more famous in 1977 when she launched first a local and then a national anti-gay rights campaign. If any of you saw the movie Milk that came out a few years ago, she figured really prominently in that as the villain. She was also well known as the Florida Orange Juice Girl, as she built herself. I'm also going to be talking about Beverly LaHaye. She was also really well known for writing marriage and sexual manuals, partly by herself and partly with her husband Tim LaHaye, who's now really well known for the series of apocalyptic novels, the Left Behind series. And as I say, she's continued to write. But she also, in 1979, founded Concerned Women for America, which continues today to be the largest conservative lobbying organization, women's conservative lobbying organization in Washington. And they always say that. At any place that you find CWA, they say, we're CWA, the largest conservative women's lobbying group in Washington. And I have a book that she wrote in 1979, months, like 3 months after she founds the organization. It says, CWA, soon to be the largest women's conservative lobbying group in Washington. So, chutzpah. And then the third woman never claimed political leadership at all. Her name is Maribel Morgan. Some of you might remember her if you were around in the 70s. She wrote a very famous book called The Total Woman. And this was a part of a series of seminars. They went all around the nation teaching people how to be the total woman, the total Christian woman. And this was very much based around the idea of submission. She said that her marriage had not gone well for the first few years until she realized that she and her husband weren't living in a godly way. They weren't living in the way that God had ordained based on Ephesians 5 and the idea that Christ is to be the head of the man is to be the head of the woman, and that through this sort of gendered hierarchy, we can create families that then are the basis of a healthy, godly society. And so this was sort of the basis of her idea about the family. This is what she supported. But if you read into these books, she really pushed back against that as well in interesting ways. She tells a story about wanting to play tennis. One afternoon, she wants to play tennis. Her husband does not want her to play tennis. She goes and plays tennis, and she says to her readers, the principle of submission just didn't come into it. And there are a lot of things like this. There are a lot of moments in which the principle of submission just doesn't come into it. And it's always Maribel who gets to decide that. So there are compromises that are possible. There's also a sense that submission is not just good for men. It's not just what God wants and something that then women have to suffer through because God ordained it, but that submission is something that's good for women ultimately too. The least generous way of interpreting this is as a manipulative system, which is what most scholars have said. But this idea that if you're submissive to your husband on most things, then you can build up a lot of goodwill in order to influence him on the big decisions. And this is explicitly a part of submission doctrine in this period. What's really interesting to me is Anita Bryant's response to submission. This is something she really struggles with all through all 10 books. And in 1976, she has a chapter called The Submission Battle, which I think in itself is really telling. The idea of submission is based around this idea that it's natural, that these are natural roles. And it's very clear in all of these women's writing that this is not something that's coming naturally, which is in itself a kind of interesting pushback. But Bryant says, she starts the chapter, this woman needed to have a blog, but it's just too early, and her writing is just like, you think you're reading a blog. She writes, submission, baloney. Who does he think he is? Mutter, grumble, storm. Sound familiar, girls? Be honest. She goes on to say, frankly, I think many Christian women today trip over the whole idea of submission. I know I have. And throughout most of the chapter, she seems to be saying, we've tripped over it, but it's what we really need to do. Submission's really important. And then at the end of the chapter, she takes a sharp turn towards what has been the tradition of feminist theology on this issue, saying that there's been a lot of emphasis in conservative theology on wives, submit yourself to your own husbands as unto the Lord, which is Ephesians 5:22, but much less, it seems, on Ephesians 5:25. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it. And this has been exactly how feminist theologians for years have been talking about submission, have been saying, this is supposed to be a system of mutual respect. This was never a system of gender hierarchy. And she distinguishes herself from feminist theologians, but still uses this argument in a way that demonstrates how a conservative theology can also incorporate more more diverse elements. And so this gets into the relationship between feminism and conservative women. These women, as I said, were absolutely anti-feminist. They identified as anti-feminist. Beverly LaHaye cites as her reason for founding the Concerned Women for America that she went to the National Women's Year Conference in 1975 in Houston, and she thought that this is a little disingenuous of her, I think, but she thought it was going to be this great inclusive movement of all the things that women were concerned about. And she got there and was surprised that not only were conservative delegates being excluded, but that they were being openly made fun of. And she has this real sense that feminism is coming to seem like it's the politics of all women, that it speaks for all women, and she says, it doesn't speak for me. It doesn't speak for my politics. And there needs to be something for conservative women so that their voices can be heard. And so the point that I want to make here is that this is an anti-feminist movement, but it's not therefore an anti-woman movement in the way that we might want to see. It's based in many ways around women's discussions of gender roles. It's based on an idea of a system that will create a better world for women, albeit an anti-feminist one. And I think that when we think about New Christian Right responses to feminism, we think more about this quote by Pat Robertson that I'm sure some of you have heard in some form, whether or not it's been attributed to him. He wrote to supporters in 1992 that feminist efforts in support of the Equal Rights Amendment were, quote, about a socialist, anti-family, political movement that encourages women to leave their husbands, kill their children, practice witchcraft, destroy capitalism, and become lesbians. It's a nice little checklist. And so it's really hard not to parody a movement that is saying things like this. It's almost parodying itself. And it comes to seem like a really anti-woman movement. But if we look at the writings of women within the movement, we see somewhat more subtle interpretations. We have a quote from Anita Bryant 20 years earlier saying, "Think of today's unhappy women who struggle to usurp men's authority. Their efforts can only be fruitless and result in self-defeat and misery because I can't see where they're supported by God's word." And in some ways, this is really similar to the interpretation that Pat Robertson is giving us. These are unhappy, unsettled women who are going against an important hierarchy. But on the other hand, it represents everything that seemed wrong with feminism to anti-feminist religious women, and that was that their system of gender, their system of family, was based on people having both rights and responsibilities, that women and men had rights and responsibilities to each other, and that feminism seemed to be threatening that. And so they weren't as concerned about women practicing witchcraft and destroying capitalism as they were with feminism giving men an excuse to forego their responsibilities. So, for example, they interpreted that feminism was valorizing single motherhood in a way that would allow men to leave single mothers and not pick up their roles as fathers. We see this especially in the reactions against the Equal Rights Amendment, where they're concerned that women are going to be drafted, women are going to lose all of the protections that they have as women. And so this is, as I say, a really sincere politics based on a particular vision of gender. Which brings us back to Sarah Palin, who sparked her own controversy in May 2010 when she started to identify as feminist, which is this huge sea change in terms of what we're seeing in the 70s to what we're seeing now. She started referring to the emerging conservative feminist identity, Tea Party feminism, pro-life feminism, my favorite, Mama Grizzly feminism. Do you remember that video? And so what's interesting about this is that the conservative women's movement has, in the past 10 years, started to incorporate, instead of fighting back against this idea that feminism is a politics that represents all women, and saying, no, we're anti-feminist and we're pro-woman, they've started to understand how that language isn't making sense to people, and they're saying, okay, feminism does represent all women, and here's what it represents to me. And I think that that's really interesting. If we look at the birth control controversy that's been raging in the U.S. in the past couple of weeks, I'm seeing nods, so I assume that that's being covered. And the thing that liberal commentators have been especially concerned with is that the official hearing had a diversity of witnesses by race, by religion, by age, but they were all men, super diverse range of men, speaking about birth control to Congress. And the assumption there has been that if only women had been allowed at the hearing, and there were women at a separate hearing for Democrats that Republicans refused to attend, if women had been allowed to be at that hearing, they would have spoken in favor of birth control. But I don't think that that's universally the case. There are conservative women who have, in fact, on the web and on mass media outlets, been speaking against birth control for principled reasons, and they've been dismissed either because we're not seeing them or dismissed because they must be, as I've said, suffering under some kind of false consciousness. And so what I've hoped that I've demonstrated is that, in fact, there's a much, much broader movement and much broader reasons for them to be doing this. And so I want to end by summing up my two central points. The first is that this movement, this modern conservative Christian movement in the United States, has had gender as a central concern since its beginning. And not only has it been concerned with gendered politics, but has been heavily influenced by female leaders. The second point that I hope I've conveyed is that women like Michelle Bachmann and Sarah Palin are not anomalies. Conservative Christian women have been seen as anomalies every time they pop up, not only in the late 20th century, but sort of throughout American history. There's a historian named Catherine Breckus who has this great study of conservative evangelical women pastors from 1740 to 1840. And what she finds is that every time there's a conservative evangelical woman pastor, she seems like a totally new phenomenon, even if there was a pretty prominent one only 20 years before. And she argues that the reason for this is that these women are both too conservative to be recorded by more radical women's movements and women's histories, and they're too radical to be recorded in church histories. And so every time they pop up, they seem completely foreign. And I think that that's still happening to us. I think that women like Bachman and Palin don't fit well into our interpretive categories. And so when we see them pop up, we have no idea what to do with them, even though there are precedents like Bryant, like Beverly LaHaye, like Maribel Morgan. And so I hope that, having attended this talk, the next time that we see a Bachman or a Palin, she won't be quite as confusing or as new. Thank you. And I would love to have a conversation now about this. I also want to mention, I also talk about Tammy Faye Baker and Catherine Coleman in my dissertation, if anyone is interested in talking about them. I say things. I fell in love with Tammy Faye Baker, and that's how I started pursuing this project, because she's such an interesting figure in American religious history. She's largely been forgotten by serious scholars, partly because she doesn't seem like an entirely serious figure. Does everyone know who Tammy Faye Baker is? She's well known for her mascara, because of the scandal that brought down the ministry in 1987, the Bakers have not been taken seriously, even though they were really, really influential in their day. Not only did they have a 24-hour internationally broadcast satellite network, they also had a Christian theme park that was the third most popular theme park in America after Disneyland and Disney World. And so I talk about Tammy Faye Baker largely to say that I think that she's really influential in creating a kind of women's culture within televangelism, and that televangelism is a really important part of building up the evangelical culture that supports the new Christian right. I also think that she's interesting because her politics of sexuality end up being so different than the other women that I look at. Anita Bryant and Beverly LaHaye are both very anti-gay throughout their careers. Anita Bryant is just now coming back into the public and doing these same sorts of events. And Tammy Faye Baker actually becomes a real ally of the gay rights movement after the scandal. And I think that this is partly because people in the gay community are really making fun of her and doing Tammy Faye drag shows and things like this. But she's so earnest that she honestly doesn't understand that she's being made fun of, and she thinks that she is receiving support from this community in a way that she's not receiving support from the church community in which she grew up. And so she starts hosting drag shows and lookalike contests and all kinds of things to raise money for AIDS. She ends up being she writes advice to people who write into a queer youth magazine, and so becomes this really, really strange figure in the new Christian right, and who's eulogized fondly. When she dies in 2007, she's eulogized fondly both by Christian conservatives and by the gay rights movement. So those are the reasons I'm interested in her. Sure.
Observation first. Partly as a fellow historian, I think one of the things I'm always sensitive to American historians is the ways in which they don't always recognize the enormous exceptions that country represents. And I know the argument that I wanted to talk slightly about that. Religious decline, I think I would want to argue that the emergence of a pretty right-wing conservative evangelicalism is ultimately about the decline of a moderate Christianity. Statistically, the United States is very different from Europe and Canada in terms of church attendance, things like that. So that's sort of an observation. And then focusing on Bryant, spent 5 months in the States last year in Arizona, and where there were fraught politics, and I was at a university questioning my colleagues about these fraught politics. And one of my colleagues said, well, it's like Anita Bryant. And I said, what do you mean? He said, look, the Tea Party here in Arizona have lost demographically. This is a Hispanic state. What you're representing, what you're hearing, is this howl of outrage that has disappeared off stage. Isn't that also the case for Anita Bryant in California? Because she was rooted in California.
In Florida.
Sorry?
She was rooted in Florida.
But I thought she was quite active in California.
She became active with the Briggs Amendment and the idea of keeping gay teachers out of schools. So she did, and against Harvey Milk and things, but she was based primarily first in Oklahoma and then in Florida.
My colleague's argument was that in the ways in which California was home to this thriving right-wing evangelical message in the 60s, it's gone. Living in California now is regarded as this outlaw liberal state, and that the stridency of that right wing represented its exit. So I guess I'm wondering what you think of this argument.
So California has always really been seen, I think, as a kind of outlaw state, starting with its history in the Wild West and the gold rush. It was really seen as this place of unattached single men who are a little bit dangerous and a little bit radical in different kinds of ways. I think that in terms of Bryant's own career, there's a really interesting autobiographical parallel with the kind of declension narrative that she's telling. She grows up in rural Oklahoma and has a very religious upbringing in exactly the kind of moral traditionalist milieu that she then imagines was American history at that moment. She then moves to Miami and is overwhelmed immediately, and the way that she talks about American history really traces that as well. She believes that in the 1950s there was a Christian nation, and then suddenly things became really scary, and specifically around sexuality. And so Miami had actually had a pretty big gay population and a pretty swinging gay scene for a long time, as had San Francisco. And it was when this legislation came up that she really started to notice it. But in Florida specifically, they weren't able to pass a similar anti-discrimination bill until very, very recently. And so I wouldn't say necessarily that they won in that state at the same time that the Christian right is becoming so strident. But I do think that within the nation as a whole, the Christian right has reacted to things that have ultimately become more ascendant than the Christian right has. And part of that, I think, is that Anita Bryant became this figure that gay activists could really rally around, that before this, the gay rights movement had been really fractured over a lot of different things, and Anita Bryant presented sort of a clear and present danger that brought that movement together nationally. So it doesn't really speak exactly to your question, but I think that it's ultimately a little bit more complicated and it's more sort of regional. I think it probably does make sense in California, but not as much in Florida.
We saw a little soundbite from Michelle Bachman, and one of the things that she said, yes, there are lots of cultures, but not all cultures are valid or something like that.
Sure.
Or valid people. So, I mean, that is, I guess my question is, that really is the underlying white supremacy kind of attitude? Is that acknowledged? Yet, I know there was a question about subtle racism, but is that acknowledged yet? Is there a black versus white component?
There isn't. There isn't, and actually, in recent years, there's been a growing African-American contingent of the Christian right that's only possible, I think, because the racism in the movement is more subtle than that and not acknowledged. I think if you gave that quotation back to Michelle Bachmann and suggested that it was racist, she wouldn't understand or wouldn't agree with you on that. I think what she thinks that she's talking about there, what she is talking about there is a pushback against moral relativism in the sense that everything's equally okay and we can just sort of, you know, we don't need to judge people, everything's great. And she, if you really pushed her, might admit that there's a cultural thing going on now talking about Islam as specifically not being a valid culture. And there's been a sort of sense that Islam is not a religion, that it's a violent terrorist culture and political thing that we need to be less liberal about, that we need to recognize as a danger, and that moral relativism is preventing us from doing that. So I think she's speaking specifically against Islam. It's more of a Arab-white thing than a black-white thing now, but it's absolutely not acknowledged except by a very small minority.
Do they get that Islam is built on a religion of submission also?
Like no. They are. And I think that it's really interesting, actually, because the far right of the movement that I'm talking about also has dress codes, obviously not a burqa, but long skirts, long hair, this kind of thing, and there isn't that recognition, and I think that there isn't that recognition because women within that culture have a sense that they're honoring God, that they're doing this willingly, that it's part of their religious expression, and that there's all, at the same time, a really strong understanding that Muslim women are being oppressed, that they're not choosing this, that this is not something that anyone would ever want to live under. So exactly the same ways that I'm suggesting that people interpret Christian conservatism in some ways are the ways that they're interpreting women's involvement in conservative Islam, and there's no parallel.
Can you say a bit more about what accounts sort of for the Sarah Palin phenomenon? You know, I mean, you say that each time a conservative woman personally seems like a new thing, but how does she even get the traction? You know, like if you analyze a little bit of speeches or tips that one gets, wouldn't necessarily propel one into.
So I think that there are a few different things going on with Sarah Palin. I think, first of all, being chosen for the vice presidency is obviously the starting point of her career. I don't think that she would have gained a following in the way she has, and that I think that choice on McCain's part was really complicated. But I think that since she has come into the limelight, she's been really effective at two things. And the first is that she's been really good with media. And evangelicals throughout history, the people that we can name in American history, have always been really good at media. George Whitefield is sort of the first example of this in the 18th century, being excellent. He has a background in theater, and he's really, really good at leafleting and advertising his meetings and paying people to oppose him so that other people will want to come to see what it's all about. And Amy Semple McPherson, earlier in the century, pioneers radio and really gets involved with radio in these ways. And I think that Sarah Palin has been a genius at social media, especially, but also at more traditional forms of media. She's very good at the soundbite. She's very attractive. She's very good at using her Facebook account and her Twitter account to whip up the kinds of sentiments that make her so popular. And those sentiments, I think, are the second thing she's really good at, which is that she's really good at playing on these fears that I've talked about, on these kinds of anxieties, without ever going too far. A lot of the pundits we've seen in the New Christian Right recently have said things that go a little bit far for most people's tastes. We saw Pat Robertson's accusation about Haiti having sold its collective soul to the devil. We've seen other people say really shocking things about Islam. And Sarah Palin has largely avoided doing that and has actually largely avoided saying very negative things. She's generally really good at saying positive things about America and about veterans and about how we came back from 9/11 that all draw on these fears, that all imply these fears, but that make people feel good. And I think that that helps her to feel, well, makes them feel good while they also feel bad. And I think that that makes her really, really palatable.
Thank you.
a couple of things that that I would be interested in your reflections on. First of all, your last comment about why there's been a blind spot in historical studies of seeing the place of these women. I immediately thought of our province, Quebec, here in Canada. And 15 years ago, I was involved with museums across the country, and in the National Museum of Quebec, the Musée de la Civilisation, did a major exhibition on women in Quebec. And I met with the curator, who was a European, who had been contracted to do this, and did a superb job. But I was doing a different kind of work. I was spending my time in the large houses of religious women in Quebec. A wonderful place to spend time. Some of these houses, you know, they were becoming the population had diminished dramatically. But in their heyday, there were 400 women living together in quite a number of these houses in Quebec. And I listened to her talk about, I asked her a little bit about the exhibition and what they were doing, and it was about the history of Quebec and the place of women. And after about an hour of listening to this, I said, well, what about Marie de l'Incarnation? What about Motheringville? What about there's a half a dozen of these extraordinary women in Quebec who are all saints. But the interesting thing is that Quebec, I would argue, is perhaps the only civil society founded by women. Men came, but it was women in Quebec. Religious women, largely with religious orders, but also a few that weren't with religious orders, that actually founded the whole society. And yet it was completely beyond, I mean, she was just shocked when I mentioned this. And of course she knew enough to know that that was likely the case, but because of the ideological preoccupation, it was simply not there. Mm-hmm. So, I had a couple questions. that was just a question.
Okay.
I think it's a really interesting issue how this
I think
how
it
this
is too.
Works, how we miss these things.
If I can comment on your footnote, I think one of the really interesting things that when we go back even looking to the 18th century or earlier is that women who become prominent in these conservative Christian communities are using the same language that they're now using the same language to justify their leadership that they have been using for hundreds of years, which is this language of exceptionalism, that God called me specifically to do this, and so I have to do it, but I'm not making a statement about women generally. And I think that that is becoming less strong now, as I said, with women more willing to claim leadership explicitly. But I think that that kind of sentiment helps us forget women's importance and also helps women to kind of disclaim their own importance in the moment.
One thing I was wondering about, In the 70s, I lived in the States in the 60s, and through the 60s, I saw so many of the churches on the evangelical side, as well as other churches, actually were taken over, at least briefly, by their young people. Mm-hmm. And at various conferences and congresses and synods and what have you, the young people, since the parents were very afraid the young people weren't going to be involved in the church, when the young people expressed an interest in the church, they were delighted. So they got them a voting position, and they voted them into committees. And then the young people immediately passed official church statements against racism, against the war in Vietnam, against all of these things, much to the absolute astonishment of their parents. And their parents felt they had lost control of these churches. So what I saw, and you know this so much better than I, but I saw a kind of blowback coming in the 70s, when the parents seized the power, the institutional power again. But it had a few curious little wrinkles in it. And one of them was, at least that I wonder if you could maybe say a little bit more about it. You don't have to be too colorful about it. And that has to do
do with, I mean, you hinted at it, it has to do with the sexual revolution. Mm-hmm. And the way in which that was ingested by this movement. So I think of things like Real Women.
Right.
As a movement. And then about how, I mean, I don't know much about this. It's not my area, to tell you the truth. There are people here who do study this stuff in great detail. But I recall, at least running across at that time, some of the publications coming out of that wing of the movement in which they were talking about, well, it was building on this notion. I remember a person who was part of that movement saying to me in Chicago when I sort of questioned their politics and their use of money, and she said, well, you know, God didn't make all the good things for the devil's children. And that meant they could own a Cadillac. So we get the beginning of the beginning of this whole gospel of prosperity and gospel of success. But along with it comes a kind of recovery of the body that is a preoccupation, I would say a little bit of a preoccupation with the sexual life, that was a good thing now. And they started writing and talking about it and having conferences on it and all that sort of thing within that wing of the movement. So they ingest the sexual revolution, but they do it, of course, within particular kinds of boundaries.
Yeah, I think that they do that with feminism in the way that I was saying, this idea of the personal and the political. They also really take this idea of liberation, of women's liberation, and reinvent it in religious and submissive contexts. Okay. Tammy Faye Baker is asked at one point how she feels about liberation, and she says, I think Christian women are the most liberated women in the whole world. I don't need feminism. And Bryant says, I was liberated when I accepted Christ as my Savior. That's all the liberation anyone should ever need. And I think that they do the same thing with the sexual revolution. I mean, Maribel Morgan is famous for writing about submission, but she's perhaps the most famous thing she says in her books is a suggestion that women spice up their marriages by meeting their husbands at the door wearing nothing but saran wrap. And she also talks about dressing up and her husband chasing her around the house in kind of a sexual way and the children watching this, but that's a good thing because then the children know that sex is part of a godly marriage. And there is this really interesting interplay that's going on at the same time that there's an explicit verbal opposition to all of these things. There's absolutely a more complicated, more interesting relationship there.
I wanted to thank Emily very much.
Thank you.
Lovely.